Thank you. Yes, this is the last presentation, and it is in a sense a workshop presentation. I feel it is there are some open ends, but I did my best put it together. It also combines some of the research interests that Johan was mentioning. Let's go forward. Yeah, play and practice, and play as aesthetic practice. I will talk first about play. First something general as a kind of warming up, and then some examples from children's play. And then I'm not going, actually, there is a slight change maybe as compared to the title, not so much talking about practice, but I think about some things that are kind of relevant for how we understand practice and what it means. For doing kind of aesthetic agency and performing and so on. What is the how can we understand what is kind of behind what is being gained through practice? How does this move forward? Is it on this? Ah, there, yes, now I find it, yes, right. That's okay. So this is the warming up part, like we had yesterday in the dance workshop. Just to note that, of course, the play is a very kind of well established in the field of aesthetics, so to say, in the modern aesthetics. That Kant talked about the free play of the mental faculties, and I'm agreeing with his model of the mind and the body and all that. But play is there. We have the emphasis on play in Gadamer, the movement between the work and its audience, and in that context he also writes about the kind of ubiquity of this kind of play movement as waves on the shore and so on. A little bit after Kant, Schiller's discussion of the play drive as the reconciliation of culture, nature, mind and body. The body, the kind of combination of mind and body, or the, how they are intricately interrelated is something that I'm relevant for this talk also. But anyway, let's go on with the warming up. So play in the everyday among adults and among academics. We may play with ideas, we play with possibilities when we are sketching things either by drawing or some planning some things or in group teamwork, thinking about what one might do. We throw up various possibilities without having to make decisions yet. I think that's a very, actually very important part of also a kind of dialogic, maybe pedagogies, but also meetings between people who should get along but don't do it and so on. Playing is also there in joking, and sometimes you say, I'm just playing around, or I'm just joking and so on. Let's try this. Is this all only playing? I mean, does it lead anywhere? What is its the relevance? And so I don't think that play is just playing. It's also more important than that, of course, depending on how it is understood, how we want to describe it. Okay, that's where I move forward. So children's play. Thierry, this is also starts with a kind of warming up thing. Children play all the time. Sometimes some people think it's a kind of harmless way of spending time, but actually not important. I mean, it's only play. That's something childhood researchers are familiar with, that the kind of the serious adult business, or some adult people think that play is something children do, but it's not important. On the other hand, there is also the idea, in Finnish at least, there's this saying that play is children's work, leikki on lapsen työt, which brings it towards the kind of learning that play, children play because it serves learning and development, or they should play because they learn by playing. And this might be true. I mean, I definitely agree that play is very, very important for development, but in certain contexts it might be described in a too kind of instrumental way, I think. So what I think that play is existentially significant, and in fact setting up this project, which is the reason we are here, there was in the background this and some of my publications also on children, what I call children's aesthetic agency, and how the self is formed and transformed there. And here I'm jumping a little bit in this slide to the last point, for example, that when we are born, we know very little. So we have to construct interpretations and both ourselves and the world. Children are not knowledgeable. They don't. They have not no verbal language. So they need to test and explore and construct. So I think it's not a kind of it's not by accident that they play so much. And the play in children's lives is quite a serious business, but it's not about just learning how to do things or imitating adults. It's also developing in a wider sense. But in order not to speak too much about this now, because I could go on for hours about that, I guess I would say that I also think that in very early childhood, in infancy, we have instances of what could be called performative play, and those can be either doing kind of songs that are part of the culture with infants, certain songs that you do together. But there is also the kind of spontaneity of those things, that certain rituals arise naturally with between parent. When I say a parent, I mean a kind of the kind of role of a parent. It need not be a biological parent. It can be someone else, but someone who has a close and intimate relationship with that very small human being. And the performative play, so this kind of rituals become kind of play in the sense of theater play, that they can be repeated to kind of refer to the previous talk. They can be repeated, and being repeated, there is variation in them. So that's a kind of performance in that sense. It's just not just acting in the moment, it's acting on the basis of some earlier actions. And because they become kind of plays, they are also something that we can, exactly for this reason, of course, sorry if I'm repeating myself, but we can do it differently and in new meaningful ways in the situation. And then, and I'm not going to go into that, but by playing together or with adults or alone, children also construct fictional worlds which develop and evolve and maybe then discarded later, sometimes not totally forgotten, but sometimes they kind of we may remember what we played because we may have some of those toys still, or we have shared it with someone. But this can be quite kind of complicated. So it's this kind of fictional words is a similarity, of course, between children's play and art in the adult world. So I definitely see a kind of a continuity between what the children do in playing and the role of art in the world of adults. Not saying that this is exactly identical, but I think they fulfill similar functions. Example. Sorry, I didn't have time to make this more pedagogical. And there is actually this action song between a Japanese mother with her child who is a toddler, perhaps still an infant, not really speaking well. It is also or kind of there is a reference to YouTube. The person who uses this example was called Indre Vatn, who is still I think active in Edinburgh. He's about 90 and he's really a kind of classical figure in infant studies, a scientist who's very open to the aesthetic side of children's and infants' life, and emphasizing very much the kind of proactive behavior and the will to share and the will to communicate in infants practically from birth. Anyway, this example. Maybe I have to perform it myself. There is the Japanese mother singing, sitting here and singing. I would sing, and then there is the toddler singing with her, and then there's the camera. Johan is the camera, he's the technician. And then they are singing, and then the toddler turns to the camera and says, ha ha. And Colvin Trevathan's comment on this example is that this is an ironic laugh. And he said that for the Japanese audience, actually, when he has recounted this, they don't like it because they think that children should kind of be obedient to their parents. So the idea of a very small child being ironic towards his mother is not kind of well received. What exactly irony means here is not something that I'm going to open here, but what it at least I think shows is the awareness of not just them. I mean, they are both engaged in the performance, then they are also performing for each other and with each other. And then there is this additional sign of being a kind of self-conscious performer, looking at the audience, the other audience, which is there represented by the camera person. So I think this is and this is what I said earlier about this performative play, because this is a performative play which is a kind of cultural heritage thing, a traditional Japanese song, but performed by them in the moment and done in different ways. It makes it a kind of a meaningful, new meaning can be added in the situation. So very, very much on the lines of what we just heard. And to add to that, I think this idea that jokes are not funny the second time, it's not true, I think. I mean, they can be very funny the second times, and they are also varied, and you can kind of laugh at the laughter and so on and so forth. But so I think that's a kind of, beginning. And yes, so similar performative plays also arise spontaneously between parents and infants. And then there is this example of facial gestures, which has been discussed a lot in a kind of infancy research. There is a name here, Andrew Meltzoff. I'm sorry not to have a Trevathan's name here, but I can give it to you later. Andrew Meltzoff is a kind of leading figure in a I would say a certain kind of paradigm of infant research, and the kind of problem that has been discussed a lot is what happens when rather newborn infant, and this was something that he kind of realized with his own newborn child. Meltzoff was showing his tongue to the newborn infant, and the infant son, I think, responded by showing his tongue. And this has been called by others the mystery of early imitation. So it's called imitation, and then there are discussions about the role of mirror neurons, and Meltzoff himself has a kind of like me hypothesis, which is very complicated and kind of describes the brain in a rather computational way. And the whole explanation is in rather mechanical terms. I would say that this is not the only explanation, and I've actually written an article on that, which has been published. The example of Emma with her grandmother, one of her grandmothers, one of the grandmothers is me. There are all we are four of them, and she's now already 6 years old. I met Emma when she was 2 weeks. They were living in Copenhagen, and inspired by these discussions about this imitation, early imitation, I held her. And then I rather spontaneously put my my tongue in one corner of my mouth, and she responded and put hers in this kind of symmetrically similar. And then we went on with a few tongue moves. She responded, and that's all normal. And of course, it might be some kind of mechanical thing going on. Who knows? But I don't find it very likely. But the interesting thing is that a few days later, when I held her, she started this. And while there are also explanations talking about the kind of, belated imitation, I don't find it very likely. I think she recognized that this is the person who likes to play with the tongue, because she never did it with other people. And so she started the play. And the point of this is just saying that this capacity for playing is there, and it's not something. In fact, if it would be only about imitation, how do we come to the kind of play stage if it's all about imitation? But there is a very strong, I think, idea about children's learning as imitation. And I think it's not, of course, we could talk more about mimetic mimesis, which is not a kind of strict imitation, but anyway, going forward now, yes. So with elements to this general, no, right, now structures of experience. This is so. On the one hand, we talk about an experience, and John Dewey, a singular, consummatory, perhaps eventful, revelatory experience, epiphany, but it can also be a minor thing in life. I said that Johan might mention this, my dissertation, because it was about environmental aesthetics, and there I thought about what to do in the environment. We are in a space, so we walk through a landscape, an environment, and we are not focusing on the kind of environment, but we still get the aesthetic atmosphere. So I think we can have that kind of integration also, and aesthetic experience integrated with actions. But anyway, that's kind of the experience that takes place here and now, whether it is a kind of life-changing or whether it is a kind of minor thing that affects how we feel. But then, of course, there is also, with the English language doesn't recognize very well, we can also talk about being aesthetically experienced. And here I put these words in German and Finnish and Swedish, which are better than English in this way, because there are different terms, as I think. I mean, there are discussions, and even Schusterman has noted this also, that the English language lacks this capacity, being experienced, having an experience, and being an experience. Erfahrung, elämyskokemus, upplevelseerfarenhet, they are point to different things. And we become aesthetically experienced through aesthetic practices, which can be very different than receptive aesthetic practices, or more productive aesthetic practices, and mostly, of course, both in some way. This builds up various aesthetic competencies and makes us better at continuing in these aesthetic practices. And these aesthetic competencies include, I would say, ways of being. I take these ways of being from Jussi's talk yesterday, but it will also go nicely with something else, which is coming here in my talk. Okay, but still something. Well, I don't know how necessary this is, but aesthetic agency as kind of producing a shift, a change, a transformation in self and world. I very much think that there is always some transformation coming. And acting with something, with things or other people. In the context of infants and children, I think what they are acting with is always primarily the other person, and that's what is most interesting. There's also research showing, or indicating, let's say, that when a toddler listens to music in a room, they behave in the same way as they behave with other people. So the kind of art itself becomes company, or some kind of subjective, someone one is playing with that. But now I'm going to a little bit different, more towards this kind of practice side, although I will approach it with a slightly different terms. I'm coming there, so to say, some phenomenological insights. First, Merleau-Ponty, and this is what takes place in these aesthetic practices. This also links to some things that came up yesterday, but for Merleau-Ponty, expression is not the pressing out of something from our inner self towards the world, but it's rather a modulation of existing internalized structures, structures of language, structures of seeing, structures of hearing. So when a writer, an author, for example, think of this, that the language is expressive, or that we get kind of a sense of a style or a voice or something like that, something particular and personal. It's actually about modulating the language that is at the same time a structure that kind of maintains us. It's not inside, it's not outside. It's a structure that is on both sides, in a sense, in the very interface. The same when he writes about, for example, Cézanne's painting, it is not, it is exactly in that in between, and it's interesting in the hand and the eye, and how the kind of that kind of painting then informs how we see generally That's his way. But I think this idea of expression as modulation of these existing structures is very interesting, because if you think that the subject is not something that is just inside, artists effect changes in such structures and establish new meanings, and likewise when a parent or a toddler changes something in the performance, it changes in something in the ways we are together. There is another kind of classic comes from psychoanalysis and psychiatry, Daniel Stern, who described these early ways of ways of being together, that's what kind of these small children learn through various ways of playing together. So they again, I mean, you have this, yeah, well, I'll skip that with the work, but another thing that Nolotonti emphasizes in Phenomenology of Perception and elsewhere is it's kind of sedimentation of meaning through becoming experienced. It's like on the ground, there are different layers which are there, and we do not kind of necessarily consciously pay attention to them. So this is now going to the practice side, what is gained through practice, and through what I recently found really interesting, although I've used this idea earlier and already in this thesis, but the tacit dimension. And when I reread this, I mean, this is Michael Polanyi. He wrote one book, several books, but anyway, one was Personal Knowledge. He describes a little bit, goes into this, but then there is this small book. I actually have it here. I love philosophers or scholars. Small, which is the tacit dimension. And anyway, the library copy from Jyväskylä. But I mean, the tacit dimension has many, many kind of levels. And I thought about it as a kind of tacit perception earlier, just being in a room, experiencing spaces, experiencing environments, all these kinds of things. We don't pay attention to the kind of atmospheric things, which makes up for how we feel to be here. Do we feel well? Do we? And then maybe ultimately think that, oh, it's so beautiful, but we can't always pay attention, exactly say what it is about. He, in his earlier book, Personal Knowledge, he also writes about this focal and subsidiary awareness. And this, I think this, which is a quote from Polanyi, this originally published in 1966, this tacit dimension, where he describes the phenomenal structure of tacit knowing, and he notes that he talks about tacit knowing, not knowledge. He likes his knowing because it's something that we do, so it's not a kind of body of knowledge. We are aware of that from which we are attending to another thing, from which we are attending to another thing in the appearance of that thing. For example, a human face. We are aware of whether how it looks, but we can't kind of point out why it is that it looks, you look happy or you look sad. It's kind of overall thing. I'm not maybe able to explain it at this, but I still find it a very fascinating and somehow very kind of good, interesting way of putting it. So, and this is the from to structure of the tacit dimension. And it actually encompasses all forms of personal knowing. So also in philosophy or science, and in, he was a scientist himself originally, whatever we do, there is this kind of from to structures, there's something from which, the kind of ground from which we attend to other things. And he, and this is not, of course, I mean, his terminology, he distinguishes this subjective. To him, it is about being subject to, for example, desires, ideas, and feelings. So there we are not kind of, we are not subjects here in the sense that Cole would like us or interested in. But instead, he uses the personal. And the interesting thing is that this idea of personal knowing, it involves also social practices, norms, choices, and elements of self-education. These elements of self-education is an expression he uses. So, and this is again my suggestion that the tacit dimension is not just about know-how, which is It has often become kind of thought of as kind of know-how, knowing how to do things. But it also includes a know-why, because it's about, it includes these social practices, norms, and choices. A know-why, which might not be so conscious, but still it is there. So I think that makes it kind of even more interesting. And here is a slight criticism of Polanyi, who also writes that, I mean, he writes about this pianist, and he says that if you kind of start paying conscious attention to the fingers while playing a piano, then the pianist can temporarily paralyze his movement, or he's no longer able to play when he's looking at his fingers. If he becomes too aware of the fingers, they stop kind of get out of the situation. But I'm not sure about that. I'm saying not necessarily. Yes, the fingers are just objects for him or her. So this is my kind of thesis or suggestion in the performance as an aesthetic act. The performer is conscious of their fingers, hands, arms, legs, body as an integral part of how they perform. In the context of aesthetic practices, the tacit dimension is not physiological, but comprises skills with cultural meaning, exactly as Polanyi also says. So I think there's kind of ways one should continue with Polanyi, through Polanyi, but also criticizing him himself. And now I come to the very end. So, of course, aesthetic in this talk has been about an aesthetics of agency, performance, and moreover, intersubjective. What to do with this? Well, we might think that in doing things in the world, in acting with others, living beings or objects, unforeseen situations arise. And they involve affordances or hindrances that are new and call for response, spontaneity, improvisation, and also harbor an element of freedom, because we can do it this way or that way and so on. We don't know what to do, but we have to do something, and it's a lot, rather kind of tacit decision that comes about. The tacit dimension and being aesthetically experienced prepare for the new, for breaking the rules in meaningful ways, for expression and transformation that is not just undergone, but also somehow enacted. So this is the end.